If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
As we have watched these wildfires in California, it's tragic and it's horrible. And what I did know at all was that the California state prisons have a system whereby inmates can volunteer to actually help fight the fires. And they are paid, my understanding is, approximately $10 for a day in doing so. And at first blush, I thought, that sounds like a great idea. Give the firefighters, give the inmates some self-esteem, make them, maybe train them to do something that they can use when they get out of jail. But there are a lot of people who object to this whole process. And there is some reason to object to it, in my view. With us to discuss this issue is the foremost expert in this arena, Bianca Tylich. She is the founder and executive director of Worth Rises. She's one of the experts in the prison industry, ways to dismantle and end the exploitation of impacted people. And her work has saved the public millions of dollars in the long run. Bianca, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen.
So I'm going to repeat what I just said. So it's fair to say that the California inmates are doing this on a voluntary basis.
Well, I don't think that would be fair to say. I think it is noteworthy to understand that the entire carceral environment is very coercive. And people who are incarcerated in California and prisons across the country cannot actually choose to work or not work. They're required to work. And from there, obviously, there are some opportunities in terms of which, types of work they do. But nobody really chooses to work for pennies an hour under the threat of punishment and other types of effects.
And I think some prisons, if I'm not mistaken, will actually give you good time if you do certain jobs or you work, and so that there is a coercive element there because most people want to work to get the good time. Is that fair to say?
That's right, yeah. Some of these facilities will allow you to get some good time credit, but that in many ways isn't really, I think, absolve people from not being able to have basic worker and employment rights as they work and do things in our society that have tremendous value.
Let's just talk briefly about the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery. I have dealt with the Constitution for many years as an attorney, probably 38, and three as a law student, and I did not know there was an exception to the 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery. Can you tell our listeners what that exception is?
Sure. So you're not alone. We did some research and found that 88% of Americans do not know that this exception exists. As you mentioned, the 13th Amendment is celebrated for having abolished slavery, except within that language, it says except as punishment for a crime. And so what that means is that slavery is actually very much still legal in our country, so long as it is used as criminal punishment. And I think that should be something that is very concerning for all of us because, I think many would agree that having a protection from slavery is a basic human right that all people should have at all times. Saying slavery is okay when is a really difficult sentence to end.
And a slippery slope, I suppose, right?
Absolutely. Actually, on that just really quickly, the slippery slope has actually presented itself. There is, an active case with the NCAA in terms of, college athletes being able to earn money, for playing in college sports. And one of the arguments made by the NCAA is actually in relation to the 13th Amendment. And they've claimed there are circumstances in which people work and are not paid, and this should be another one.
Interesting. And there's some historic bad history after the 13th Amendment was actually passed concerning the South and the African Americans in the South. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how that worked and how that sort of doesn't bode well in the slippery slope we're talking about?
Absolutely. So after the 13th Amendment passed, there, and with that exception, many states began to pass black codes. And black codes were essentially laws that criminalized sort of everyday life only for free black people. And so things like being unemployed was now a crime that only applied and was only a crime for the newly freed black folks across the country, but particularly in the South. And by making that a crime that someone could get arrested for, it could very easily therefore trigger that exception clause. And so what happened was we ushered in the most brutal era of convict leasing sort of ever known, where many people who were newly freed after the Emancipation Proclamation and 13th Amendment were in fact just reclassified, you know, under the label, the horrible label of sort of criminal and criminal activity that were in these made up sort of codes. And through that, were just re-enslaved.
It's interesting. There have been several novels that I have read in the last 2 years that talk about some of the boarding schools that Native American children were placed in. And and you see a lot of that. You know, the novels were based on historic fiction, that they were actually loaned out to private businesses and farmers to do their work for profit. And, you know, prisoners, boarding school kids. I mean, it just seems like there is a real opening for abuse here.
Absolutely. And I think what history will also show is that in some cases, as awful as this may sound and maybe in conflict, is that the entire system of convict leasing at times led to more brutality than even slavery, because as states began leasing incarcerated people to private businesses, those businesses had no stake in those people's lives. And so they would work them to the bone. Mortality rate was actually much higher. More people died. These business owners didn't care, because the next day they would simply get a new person from the system for whatever the daily rate was. During antebellum slavery, the people that you enslaved, and in that case owned, you actually had to care for. Under convict leasing, you did not. And so it led to an incredible amount of brutality. And that brutality built much of our infrastructure, and both public infrastructure and corporate infrastructure, during the Reconstruction era. And some of our states, in fact, like Alabama, during the late 1800s, was making as much as 73% of state revenue came from the practice of convict leasing.
Interesting. Bianca Tylik is the founder and executive director of Worth Rises. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about the privatization of prisons, and we're going to continue this conversation. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back. We are talking to Bianca Tylik, who is the founder and executive director of Worth Rises. And we're talking about this very interesting issue of inmates working. And Bianca, I guess I would like to play devil's advocate here, because I know my listeners are saying to their radio, now, it's good for inmates to work. It's good for their self-worth. It keeps them busy. It keeps them out of trouble. It may teach them skills in how to cook or how to do certain things that they can use when they get on the outside. Why aren't these valid reasons to allow the inmates, even on a voluntary basis, to work as they are working in the prisons in our country?
Sure. Well, I would say two things to that. I think, one, everybody who is opposing the current practices within prisons and jails today are not saying that people incarcerated should not have dignified opportunities to work. All of us work, right, on the outside. And people who are incarcerated also want to work. But there is a difference between work and slavery, right? And so I think it's noting that there are many benefits, to your point, like both training but also purpose-driven, the ability for people to be able to support their families, all of those things to deal with idleness. But you shouldn't be enslaved. And your labor shouldn't be devalued or exploited. And so that's, the advocacy that's being done, and we, run a campaign at the federal level called End the Exception to End the Exception in 13th Amendment. It's not about ending work. It's about ending slavery and ensuring that people who are inside are valued in those ways. And I think the second thing to that end is that, you know, the prison environment in and of itself is a really, really traumatic, coercive environment in many ways. And so I think there needs to be, anytime we have vulnerable populations, additional protections and also opportunities where we know that the things that people are doing inside can actually be transferred into opportunities on the outside. Too many jobs that are available in prisons and jails are not available to people when they leave. And in fact, when we were talking about the incarcerated firefighters, it was not until just 2 years ago that people who are incarcerated in California who are firefighting while they were incarcerated were allowed to actually become firefighters on the outside. For many, you know, years, decades even, somebody could firefight while they were incarcerated but not be able to become a firefighter when they came home. So I think it's, you know, something that we have to kind of review in its totality, so that the benefits that we think are assigned to labor are, you know, actually come to fruition.
We talked about this in the prior segment, that the 13th Amendment has a little known exception, and that is for people convicted of a crime, and slavery can be implemented in that situation. In order to change that whole dynamic, what would have to happen? Would it have to be a federal law, do you believe, or do you think it would actually have to be a constitutional amendment?
So it has to be a constitutional amendment. Proposal actually exists. So there is a proposed constitutional amendment, a joint resolution between the Senate and the House, proposed by Senator Jeff Merkley and Senator Cory Booker, and on the House side by Congresswoman Nikema Williams, that would end the exception in 13th Amendment. It is a very short amendment of 14 words. Simply says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude may be imposed as punishment for a crime. And so it is really for us to actually pass that constitutional amendment. But I do want to say that as we continue that fight in Congress and on the federal level, there are many states looking to do this within their state constitution. Obviously, states can do more for their citizens, their residents, than the federal government does. And so 8 states in just the recent years have actually passed state constitutional amendments to end this practice. And unfortunately, in November, California, the initiative in California lost, which I think is particularly ironic and really demands a reckoning from Californians around how they voted.
We only have a few minutes left, but I want to talk about this bigger issue of privatization of prisons. And your organization, Worth Rises, is against that. And can you just bullet point very quickly, and this is obviously what we're talking about here, is that, you know, a state would pay a third party, a private party, to run a prison and to actually do all the work that that the state would do had the state had been a state prison. What are the downsides of privatization?
Yeah, I just want to clarify that, you know, the prison industry is an $80 billion industry. It is not just about private prisons, which is typically like the operation of a facility, but even within public facilities, almost everything is being outsourced, from healthcare to food service to telecom, you name it. And that has created incredibly exploitative environments. We're talking about charging families $1 a minute for a phone call out of prison in 2025, right? Where one in three families with a loved one who's incarcerated goes into debt simply because of the cost of communication and visits. Things like that, healthcare companies that are going bankrupt because they don't want to pay out medical malpractice lawsuits when they decided to pocket taxpayer dollars and not provide services, healthcare services, to people who are incarcerated. So it's much, much bigger than simply the operation of a private facility, which only about 8% of incarcerated population are in. Privatization is a massive issue that impacts people who are incarcerated, and not just people who are incarcerated, but taxpayers.
And we just have a minute left. And some of the things that I was reading is, you know, even the unions, the guards don't don't really like the privatization because there's just not a not the same safety guards that are put up by the state. And it seems like, you know, there's just more violence, lack of accountability, and an incentive to keep the population high, because the more inmates, probably the more payments that are available, that are required. And as you said, not just the prison itself, but the outsourcing of all these other kind of orbital issues. But
that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, can you tell us just, we've got a minute left. Can you tell us just briefly about Worth Rises and how people can get more information about your organization? It's very interesting what your organization does.
Thank you so much, Karen. Yes, Worth Rises, we're a national organization that works to end the exploitation of people who are incarcerated and dismantle the prison industry. And you can check out our work at worthrises.org or follow us on any social platform at Worth Rises to learn more about the prison industry and what's happening in our country and what you can do about it.
And it's a very significant thing because we have 1.2 million, last I looked, of incarcerated people in our country, and that impacts a heck of a lot of families. Bianca, thank you so much for joining us. Again, that's Bianca Tylik, and she's with Worth Rises.